For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Are you ready to take your screenwriting career to the next level? If you're a new or aspiring screenwriter who feels lost or stuck in your career, the Working Writer School is here to teach you what writing courses don't.
Former student Dylan Evans said, "There are a ton of writing classes out there, but this course helped me work through the stuff that I couldn't find anywhere else. I feel more prepared and more knowledgeable to take on the next phase of my writing career."
Writer Nicole Bennett said, "After taking this course, I have a clear framework for the mindset, productivity, networking, and financial management skills needed for longevity in this industry."
And Jay Burlingham calls this course the map. "This course has given me a map that I will return to again and again as I move forward in my career as a writer."
Use code MMIH for 10% off from now until January 31st and go to theworkingwriter.com. That's theworking, W-E-R-K-I-N-G, writer.com to sign up today.
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on Tubi. Watch it on Tubi, people. Yay.
I'm Liz Banishel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has made two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, which is also on Tubi, but it's not a new thing, so I guess it's not as cool. I'm a distribution consultant who does sales, and I used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative. This week, we welcome writer and director Cecilia Minucci on the show to talk about her latest feature, Life Upside Down, starring the amazing Bob Odenkirk, Danny Houston, and Radha Mitchell. She talks about how she got her amazing cast, how they shot the movie during the pandemic, and her overall philosophy of filmmaking in general. After that, we play another round of The Game. But first, Ulrich, how are you?
I'm doing well. I feel like I'm, you know, just dealing with, like, I don't know the numbers for The Alternate yet, but, like, I have a sense it's not going to be good. Like, I just don't think it's going to be great. Well, because...
Well, you haven't gotten one report yet? No reports at all?
No reports yet. No reports.
Wait, when did you release?
September.
Oh, yeah. You're okay. It's like the data's still being delivered. Yeah, that makes sense.
He says like in 2 weeks or whatever. Yeah, I don't think it's gonna be good because, like, you know, I really don't know what the good gauge is, but, like, you know, just basing off of IMDb likes, like, or reviews or whatever, or ratings, we don't have that many, you know, like 150 or something. So it's like,
it's pretty good.
Like, it's good, but, like, I don't know. Like, I guess I'm not sure what the correlate, like, what I should look for a correlation to, like, sales and, you know, like, attention, you know, like, how do you know, like, how many sales you're making? I mean, I've had plenty of people, like, email me and text me and, you know, whatever, tell me they've watched the movie and bought the movie and rented the movie or whatever, but it's like, I don't know. So I am very cautious going into these first numbers of what it'll be. But yeah, I think I'm just like sort of like, okay, well, you know, the movie did what it did. It's cool. You know, like, I mean, I could do more. I should be doing more promotion of it, but I'm only going to do as much as I can do, you know. But I think I'm just like sort of like coming to terms with like, yeah, that's what the movie was. That's great. People liked it. Got some good reviews. Okay, it's cool. You know, it didn't blow the doors off my career in the way that I hoped it would. But, you know, again, you know.
Well, you're attached to a feature project that you're not having to fundraise for.
That's,
you know,
true.
You've had other meetings. You're developing projects with other writers. I mean, and
that's,
I also
true,
think, you know, Naomi McDougall-Jones and I, a long time ago, we talk about her on the show a lot, but we did this survey of 104 filmmakers, and we're going to have this piece published in Filmmaker Magazine in a few weeks, actually.
Mm.
And I say this all the time, but, like, no one is doing well. Like, you know, I think our expectations are really high, and then we get very disappointed in distribution because distribution never reaches our expectations. Even if we do very well, it's never to the expectations that we have for ourselves or the standards we have for ourselves. And I think it's the story you tell. So, like, I get that you're very honest and very, you know, like humble on the podcast, but like publicly outside of the podcast, you don't have to say, gosh, I wish we did better, right? Like
right.
The story you tell is like the film is a success. The film is a success.
I mean, it is a success no matter what, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know,
yeah.
It won all these awards and it did well. It's got great reviews. We're fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. Like there's all these really great things that it did. But it's like when it just comes down to the money, right? It's like that's what I'm sort of focusing in on, you know? It's like, will I be able to pay back like any amount to my investors, you know? And so that's the concern. But I guess I don't know, right? So I'm just kind of guessing and I'm negatively projecting like what I think is going to happen. But like I really don't have any idea. So we'll see. And maybe over 5-6 years, maybe I will be able to pay some back, you know? So I think there's that is helpful too. It's just, you know... I think you always want it to be like this big thing where you get that deal or you get this, you know, like you get on a streamer, you get on this, you get on that, you get a cable deal or whatever. And we didn't get any of those things. And, you know, I think like that's very normal because we didn't have stars or anything. So it's totally acceptable. But yeah, I feel like, you know, just sort of acknowledging like the movie's done what it's gonna do, you know, for the most part, and
letting
you know,
go a little bit,
and just being proud of it, you know, being, I mean, like, you know, we once won all these awards. I had lots of great experiences with it. I've had like lots of people say lots of nice things. So I feel like in the end, it's like, yeah, it did good stuff. You know, I was compared to Oscar nominated Everything Everywhere All at Once multiple times in reviews. So like, I feel like that is pretty neat just to like have people be like thinking of my movie in the same sphere as like a big, awesome movie like that, you know? So yeah, no, I am overly positive about it. And I mean, I get like the whole projecting and like, you know, like here's the story you tell and everything, but it's also just like, you know, there's also a reality financially that I think, like, you know, being on the show, it's like, it's my duty to be open about, you know?
Yeah. Oh, it sucks. It sucks for indie filmmakers. You're one of every single other indie filmmaker who is not a millionaire from their indie feature.
Right.
It's a very, very stark reality for all of us, but we keep doing it.
Yeah.
And I get it. And I've come to a lot in similar ways with my projects.
I do like, it's also unfair for myself too, because I'm putting like too much weight on this project. Cause I'm like, if it gets made and I get to direct this movie, then it's like, oh, well, it would be like dreams come true above and beyond everything, like incredible. Like basically if I get to make another movie, it's like it was a massive success because I got to make another one, you know?
Yeah.
But like if I get paid to make another one, then it's just like, well, you struck the gold mine, you know, you know, that's, there's no more you could possibly ask for out of this experience, right? So I think like I'm really excited and hopeful that that happens. But again, I'm also not like deluding myself. Like there's a good chance this isn't going to work out, you know? So we'll just see. But it's exciting to be in the game and in the mix anyways. The other thing I haven't talked about on the show at all that I wanted to talk about, which is not movie related, is I started learning piano recently.
Ooh.
Yeah. I got an app and I got a keyboard, which I got for Christmas with like little bonus I got from my work. You know, I got it because I wanted to like, you know, have something to do with BB and like when she's a little older, like maybe get her excited about playing keyboard. So I thought like, oh, I'll teach myself. And then as she's older, gets older, I'll be able to teach her and like we can learn together. And like, it'll be like a thing that we do as a, you know, father daughter thing.
Yeah.
But now I'm just like addicted to it. Like I play every day. Like, you know, at least a half hour, if not an hour. Either I try to do it like in the middle of the day while she's napping or at night before I go to bed. And yeah, I'm like blowing through this app. I'm like on past the intermediate lesson and like I'm doing chord styling now. I just finished chord styling. I'm doing like the level 2 chord styling or something. It's like, it's pretty cool. Played all kinds of things. Oh. Game of Thrones theme. The Godfather theme I've done. I'm into the movie themes, as you can tell. Yeah, I played, what was it? Yeah, Katy Perry Firework, which is like crazy hard, but it was fun. Yeah, so it's been a cool thing. And I you know, I sit and I play and I'm like, man, you should be writing right now. I'll look like, why aren't you like writing a script? But it's like, you know, maybe what I'm hoping will happen is that I can like, you know, instead of playing an hour and a half of piano every day, maybe I play a half hour of piano. And then that other hour that I was playing piano, maybe that becomes an hour where I start to write my screenplay, you know?
Well, so yeah, I'm, you're like, engaging creatively. It's good for, it's going to contribute to your writing and yourself as a creative individual.
I hope so. I hope that, like, this whole, because I'm also doing time blocking at work for tasks is a new thing that I, like, I've heard about time blocking. I've known about time blocking forever, and I've used it before, like, in writing and stuff. But, like, now I'm trying to do it, like, you know, for everyday things. So I'm going to start, like, okay, it'll be like, okay, at 2 o'clock or whenever, it'll be, that's like my half hour of piano. And then, you know, we're going to bed earlier as a family now because
good.
You know, it's just like a thing that we're doing. But like 10 o'clock is like, you know, best new bedtime. So it's like, okay, at 10 o'clock, like I can't go to bed at 10. That's too early for me, but I can go to bed at 11. So like from 10 to 11, that'll be like, that's right now piano time, but that I'm going to make that time be writing time soon. I think that's like my new goal, is to turn that hour before bed into my new writing zone. So mm-hmm. I don't know, mm-hmm. something I'm working on. I think I'm still too into the piano to give it up at from 10 to 11 at the moment. But I think soon enough, I'll transition, and like my hour and a half of piano, sometimes 2 hours, is going to go down to, like cut that in half. And then the rest of it will go to writing. We'll see.
That's really cool that you like something that much, right? Like that's worth writing home about. That's amazing.
I'm addicted to it. It's like like I was playing video games on the weekend, you know, like, and then playing piano. And now I don't play video games anymore. I just play the piano because it's like,
you're like an advertisement for like
for piano,
for this keyboard program, for the app, for a healthy living. I don't even know.
Simply Piano, people. It's worth it. If you want to learn piano,
No more piano. No.
Do it.
No.
It's fun. Did you play piano?
I played piano for like 9 years. Oh my God. Piano for a long time. Yeah. I played almost every instrument very poorly every single time.
Wow.
And I played steel string guitar, nylon string, like classical guitar. I played violin. I played piano. I did singing lessons. Wow. I did recorder. I did bells. I'm trying to think of what else I did. I did dance class. And always just mediocre. Always just like a mediocre. Never. And my hands are really small. So like that was a fun little thing to deal with. What I'm doing, which I think is really, I haven't talked about it on the podcast, is I am taking improv classes.
Uh-huh.
And I have taken 2 so far, and I have my 3rd one on Friday. And I always get very, very nervous, but I always leave really satisfied. Like, it's almost like you're like, oh, I gotta get out of the house, I gotta exercise, I gotta do this thing that's good for me. And then you feel so good when you're done. That's like what improv is for me.
Wow.
It's like, I feel very accomplished. And I understand why people want to be actors, because they're so nice to each other. Like, I'm very confused. Like, I go into the room, they're like, how are you? How you doing? What you up to? Like, there's this warmth that they talk to each other with, and they like want to engage emotionally, which is very uncomfortable, but I'm trying it. And they always tell you you did a good job. They're always like, great effort. Good job. I love this thing you did. Like, I get it. It's
wow.
like a nice ego boost. And I like that part of it. And improv has a lot of rules. So it's harder than I expected. But the whole point of doing improv is because I wanted to put myself in the hot seat and feel more vulnerable about what it's like to be an actor so I could be a better director. And boy, is it a vulnerable situation to be in an improv game. You have to think on your toes. It's very scary. Anything can come out of your mouth. And I think it is going to make me a better director. So for those following the travails of Liz in acting classes, I think I found the one. And it's UCB. It's UCB Improv 101.
Oh,
everybody take
nice.
It. It's really fun.
So what are some of the scenarios that you've found yourself in that you've had to react to so far in your classes?
Well, we tried different skills. So like last week, we tried giving each other a gift. So giving a gift is like you have to tell someone about themselves in the scene so they know how to react. So if I go, oh, Ulrich, you're so generous. Thank you so much for the cake you gave me yesterday. Then you know in your next line, you have to do something that's generous. That's your character for the scene. So like that's the scenario is like trying to think of a gift and then having to enact that gift you are given. Other things are, I think what's really difficult for me is like improv is very expositional. There's no grace to it at all. It's like, gosh, I love being at this grocery store at 3 a.m. in the morning. Like that's the opening line of every scene is like you have to give the scenario, the who, what, where. And I find that really tacky because as a writer, you and I are like, how do you show, not tell? How do you set up like a mise-en-scene? And they're like, no, 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 you just have to say it. And I think that's the hardest thing I'm grappling with. But I'm really glad I signed up for this. It's very scary, nice. But I'm very glad. Yeah.
Awesome.
But don't forget. Yeah. Yeah. But don't forget to support us on Patreon. To all of you out there, patreon.com/MMIH podcast. We want to give a big happy birthday. Is this new? Is this Chris Scott new?
No. I don't think so.
We thanked Chris Scott last week. Thank you, Chris Scott, again.
But I don't even know when that was from.
From five years ago. Chris Scott, you get triple thanks. Patreon is how we keep the show alive. Also, don't forget to check out gembox.io, one of our wonderful sponsors. They're a royalty-free music and SFX company with an emphasis on high-quality cinematic cues. They offer customized plans to fit your needs. Check them out. But without any more delay, here's our chat with Cecilia Minucci. Can you give us a short elevator pitch just to bring us into the ultimate context for the film for our audience?
For Life Upside Down?
Yes.
Absolutely. It came about at the very, very beginning of lockdown. Thought, how can we rescue ourselves from a terrible depression and lack of creativity, boredom, insanity, fear, doubt? And so I thought, oh, let's make a movie. That's all I know how to do. And so I came up with this idea and I ran it by these wonderful actors and they were so kind to take a leap of faith and join me in this crazy experiment. But here we are. We did it. So that's how it came about.
So many questions. How many days did you shoot the movie?
The actual shoot was about 4 weeks.
What can you talk about with regard to the budget or the resources you had as a director?
We had zero resources. It was basically, yes, no resources. All we had was this device that one of my producers, Carl Berg, put together, physically built himself, where we had microphones, iPads and iPhones, and we would, you know, physically take to these actors' homes to shoot, and I would be directing them through my computers back here at home, this very place that you guys see. And then my other producer, Jeffrey Coulter, came up with the idea of shooting a how to make the movie kind of video that we would show the actors. And so, yeah, I mean, that's how the limits and the beauty of it at the same time.
But you can't give us a number, like a rough range of what the budget was besides no money.
It was under $500,000.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Thank you for that specificity. We appreciate that.
I think, but again, it's the wrong question to ask me. And I might have given you the wrong answer. So
I'll take it.
It's more the producers should.
Can you talk a little bit about the origin of the idea for the film?
Okay, so the idea was a little bit dictated by the circumstances. The film is about disruption and how it was because of the pandemic at the time, but it could have been anything else. It could have been a tornado, an earthquake, anything that comes about disrupts our lives. And so having that in mind and having also the isolation element in mind, I thought about talking about, you know, people stuck in their place, whether they're alone and they would like to be with somebody else, or whether they're forced to be with somebody that they don't particularly enjoy being with anymore, or somebody they absolutely love to be all the time, and they don't even know who this person really is. So this is how the story started to come about. And it's basically about relationships and human condition and how we relate to one another, the ones that we want to be with, the ones that we don't want to be with, and ourselves, you know, and what we discover.
How long did you spend working on the film from coming up with the idea, you know, to it being released?
Well, okay. So the idea came about middle of April, end of April. I wrote the script in a couple of weeks. In May, we started rehearsing and talking with the actors toward the end of May, the last week of May. And then we start shooting the beginning of June through the beginning of July. Then there was a moment where I called the editor, my main editor, Anne Gusso, and who cut also other work I've done before, brilliant Anne. And Anne said, well, give me some time to also, you know, import all this material and organize it and blah, 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 and do a, you know, an assembly for you. So it was only in September that I then started, you know, cutting, editing the film, unfortunately followed by the unexpected death of my mother. And that took a couple of months away from my life and from this work. I couldn't really do.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Much. And then we started again. And so in January, we started again and we worked until last August, nonstop, cutting and doing all the special effects. Wow. There were a lot of special effects and everything was done remotely. I was working with Australia, with the Netherlands, Holland, with France, with England, and with Italy. So anyway, thank God for Zoom. And then we got into the film festival in Venice. So we had to stop and do, you know, get ready for that. And then soon after that, this other brilliant producer, Rose Kuo, managed to sell the picture. I mean, we got some interest and she made this deal and we sold the film and we had to deliver the film. So we had to rush. So now it's done and it's coming out on January 27th in multiple cities in the States. And thank you, IFC. Thank you, AMC. Thank you, everybody. Unexpected, totally, from an experiment to have, you know, a U.S. distribution. It's like,
I'm going to skip. We usually do these, you know, these six questions. I'm going to skip our last question because I looked, you know, we're doing some research. We're looking you up, an incredibly impressive background and career. I'm curious because you've worked in both the Italian cinema industry and Hollywood.
Yes.
It may be a tough question to jump into on a podcast interview. Which system do you prefer to work in? Or do you have a preference between the two?
You know, I came to America while and after I was working with different Italian film directors, such as Lina Wertmüller, Federico Fellini, the Taviani brothers, and so forth and so on. And I came to go to school here. And then from that school, I went to the American Film Institute. And through that, I ended up at the Zoetrope Studios working closely with Fred Roos, great legendary producer, though that happens to be also, you know, a producer in my films. And I stayed here. So that says it all, I guess. But it's also how life came about. One thing led to another. And Italy, I never made a film in Italy, ever. And actually, just before COVID, I was about to make my first film in Italy. I tried to make a film a few years ago in Italy, and I got it almost to shooting when the producers found out that they didn't clear the rights of the story. So we had to we had to leave. But I never really worked myself directing a picture in Italy. I would like to do it, or in Europe, in any place in Europe. I would like to do it, and I look forward to doing it. I only know the system in Europe working as not a director, but as a assistant to a director or an assistant director. So here instead is where I directed everything here. So I know the system from a very, you know, direct way. And it's the best place in the world to work in, I find, and I love it. And I'm also American, so I feel this is my other home and I defend it with all my might. And I love the way things work. And even if it's hard, it's extremely hard to make a movie here, even harder in a way, because they have more government participation and more. But you need to be part of the club. It's more corrupt. You need to know people. Here, there is more meritocracy. And it's so you have different obstacles, because I'm not American and I'm a woman. I had to fight more because of that. But the system itself, the way you work, is wonderful. And of course, there are honest people everywhere and dishonest people everywhere. And the craftsmanship in Italy, in France, it's amazing. The costumes, the special effects, the hair, makeup. I mean, it's so, the set designing is really, you know, the craftsmen there and the artists are really something. The directors of photography, you know, the American directors work with them all the time. So
I wanted to hear about this thing that you mentioned in the very beginning of our conversation. You said that you're really grateful to the wonderful actors for coming with you on this journey and agreeing to be a part of the project. But how did you get this cast? This cast is incredible. Did you have personal connections? Did you reach out to their agents? Like, how did you make it happen?
No agents. And they probably hate me for it. But no, this was talent to talent. Creative people to creative people, nobody in between us. And was the most refreshing and beautiful experience in filmmaking ever in that respect. Because in a way, that's how it should be, you know, minds, creative minds that think alike. And so I knew Bob somewhat, a little bit, because I had chosen him to be the lead of a movie I was making some years ago. And this was pre-fame and, you know, and awards and all that. And I really believed in him and I loved the way he was as a person, as a talent, as an artist. And I always thought, I want to work with this guy. Then, of course, life took different turns for all of us. And when I had this opportunity, I just called him out of the blue. I said, Bob, would you be interested? And he said, cool, I'm game. I mean, he said, cool, I'm in. I thought, oh my God, this is fantastic. This is so great. I never for once ever thought, oh, you know, I got Bob, he's famous now. Never. Bob was just this great talent the way I knew him years ago. And here we were trying to do something together. And then Radha Mitchell, she's wonderful too. And she and I, and also Danny Houston, were talking about doing something that would take place actually in Italy, in Rome, a film called Rome by Night, mm-hmm. that we almost made before COVID, and I hope I get to make still. And so I called them up and I said, hey, you know, would you be willing to? And Danny had his wife, who's English, was also here, locked in with him, and Rosie Fellner, the lovely Rosie, talented Rosie Fellner. And so all of us embarked in this adventure together, taking a risk, experimenting, and hoping that it would turn out to be something, not to be ashamed of, at least. That's what you have to go for first.
Well, you do so much. Like, I was on your website. I, you know, you write, you also publish other people's writings. You develop TV projects. You have these features. And I know, and obviously the very prolific career in music videos. I can't believe you did the Bitty Bitty Bom Bom music video. That is so cool.
I did that right there, over there on the pier, right there. I can see the pier.
So cool. It's like the best ever. I guess I'm curious if you have a priority for your career as an artist. Like, feature projects the priority? Are they the priority? Is it just about what inspires you? Like, are you strategic about you picking different projects, or is it about what fulfills you creatively?
I never been strategic to my own malaise, to my own, ruin. To my own ruin. I always gone when my heart has told me to go, and I never been calculative, but maybe I should become so. Maybe now at this tender age, maybe I should. But I think film, I don't know why, maybe that's because it's mostly my background, but when a story comes to mind or a character knocks on the door, I always immediately think film in terms of a format. But trying to be more clever and probably more with the times, I do think television as well, scripted television. However, I also been involved in a non-scripted television. I already shot 4 episodes of that with great, great actors, Jack Black, John Lithgow, Catherine Hahn, Josh Holloway. So that's in the making. For sure, I would like to try. I would like to try, you know, television, like maybe a so-called mini series kind of thing, and with great characters, you know. However, I'm working on a script for a film.
I want to hear a little bit about your approach to working with actors, because you've obviously worked with some of the best talent out there. You know, you're just dropping some of the names that you might be working with. So how do you approach that whole process?
In an honest way. I mean, I just believe in their talent. I present what I think, you know, their character could be. And then I give them quite a bit of freedom to be themselves or to be themselves within the container that I give them. And I am pretty firm at times, but I also like to give them some space to improvise. And in terms of actually technically shooting, normally, I mean, not always in this particular film because of the conditions we were in, but normally I like to, you know, shoot with a Steadicam to respect also their capacity of moving about and expressing themselves also through their bodies and the way they go about the scene. So on one hand, I like to keep, you know, close to the script and have them just elevate basically what I give them, you know, to take it to the next level. And to do that, you have to be honest about what you give them, and you have to be respectful of their talent and give them some freedom. Otherwise, you might as well do it yourself. It's no point. That's the point, is to bring in some creative minds and talent to elevate you. Elevate you, meaning you, the screenplay at first and the film later, you know?
Other than financing, is there a part of directing or the filmmaking process that you see as more challenging than other parts? I mean, like, for example, I find all of filmmaking incredibly intimidating, but I'm just curious, is it all easy for you now, or is a part of it that you don't look forward to, or does it intimidate to any degree?
No, I don't get intimidated at all. I'm sorry. And this is not arrogance. It's just honestly the way I feel. I don't feel intimidated when I'm in front of a blank page to write a screenplay. I don't feel intimidated when, you know, I am on the set. I don't feel intimidated. I just love it. And I feel totally at ease. I feel exactly I am where I'm supposed to be. But what I don't like is the wait between writing something and possibly making it. And that part where you have to look for money, you have to fight the agents, you have to, that to me is a killer. It just kills every enthusiasm and hope and dream. It's just horrific. And not necessarily produces better films. So if I could just jump from the page into the set, I would really, really like to do it. And I've been lucky. I've been able to do that 2-3 times already. So, but not other times.
Really quick, like you talked about, like staring at the blank page and not feeling intimidated. That's probably the time I feel almost the most intimidated, is when I can't get an idea out, or I like look at the page and I don't know what to write. So like, what do you do in those situations? How do you get through that process, part?
Yeah. Well, that in my case, I don't know. I never sit in front of a page, a blank page, without knowing what I'm going to do. For some reason, I think it over and I think it over, and it takes some shape within my head. When I'm sitting down, often enough, I don't even write notes or a synopsis or a log line or log, what is it called?
Outline.
An outline. Yeah. Thank you. And that was the word I was looking for. I don't even write those. I just sit down and I start writing because I already kind of worked it out in my head where it is. So the first draft is not something you want to show anybody, in my case. And sometimes in the process, I do get stuck, you know, oops, you know, what am I going to go, you know, where am I going to go with this? But, you know, I learned one thing, and I'm sure this is not a very original thought. I'm sure everybody thinks of this, but you let the screenplay tell you what to do. You let the characters tell you what to write because you've given life. It's almost like a kid, you know, you have this kid has a life of its own at a certain point, and you have to observe and respect that and listen and follow and try to imagine what this creature will do and be. And it's the same in a way. In a screenplay, you have these characters and you form them and you shape them, and they're not there yet. And they tell you what to say, what to do. And if you put in their mouth something else that you want them to say, but it's not appropriate to who they are or what you created, you will find out that it's not right. And so I let that thing guide me. Okay, now I've done, you know, I've thrown out the clay, you know, let's see how to model it, form it, you know, give it shape.
You just dispense a lot of really good advice right there. Do you have any other great advice that you've benefited from or have received or dispensed?
Be honest. Just be honest and be yourself. That's my greatest, best advice I can give to any creative person, because there is only one of you. And if you are honest and you are who you are and you write about who you believe, what you believe in, and about who you know best, and you're truthful to yourself, it's going to be unique, because there's only original automatically, because it's only one of you on this planet, and never again and never before. And so stay true to yourself and believe in yourself somewhat if you can. You know, artists are by definition insecure people. I remember Francis Ford Coppola hugged me one time and said, "You can't be an artist and feel safe, darling," you know, something like that. And I learned it later through hard times. But that's really, you know, believe in what you do. And it may not always be a masterpiece. And in fact, hardly ever is a masterpiece, but it's still something that you are called to do and you live for doing and you are meant to be doing, and do it the best you can and in the most honest way, because people will respond to that, I think. The honesty, the truth.
Wow, amazing. Well, we have a few like of these quick rapid fire questions we do at the end of the interview. We don't have time for all of them, I don't think, but I want to just see how many we can get out before we're cut off. So here's the first one. What's the best filmmaking advice that you've ever received?
We kind of just covered that one. I think we should do worst advice.
Fine. Okay, worst. What's the worst filmmaking advice you've ever received?
Copy other filmmakers. Even if you admire them, be yourself.
Do you have a goal as a filmmaker, like a certain landmark you want to achieve or anything?
An Oscar. No, just reach as many people as possible, trying to contribute to a better world by not using violence, by not exploiting female beauty. Yeah.
And last question, is making movies hard?
It is. It is. Overall, it is. It's a challenge, no doubt. It's a tough job, but it's a beautiful job. Michelangelo Antonioni used to say, if you hate somebody, don't wish them to make bad movies. Don't wish them to die. Don't wish them to get sick. Don't just wish them not to be able to work as a filmmaker. And that's really true. Because as hard as it is, it's fantastic to make movies. And I don't know what, it's a disease you have. Like, I think it was Frank Capra used to say, it's a disease, you know, that you can only cure by making more movies.
That's amazing.
I know you already called out the theatrical dates. Is there any other call to action that you want to send our audience to do to support you in any way?
Yes, just stay tuned. And in April, there's going to be another release, like a larger, I think, VOD release. Please tell your friends to go to these theaters to support these small indies, because, you know, the whole thing is kind of like... So we need to really, I still believe in making movies and I still believe in the theatrical experience, and let's support it as much as we can, especially also because we need to support the people that give us the opportunity, like IFC should be supported. You know, one of the few organizations that still embraces independent filmmakers and still believes in putting out films in theaters. God bless you, IFC.
And just so everyone knows, when Cecilia said the indie film, she did the flying ship down into the depths like failure thing. So just so people know, there's some context there.
Oh, God.
Thank you so much. This has been wonderful.
Of course. You guys are great. And thank you for having me. And best of luck with you. Go out there and make movies. Come on.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Do you love Making Movies as Hard and you want to listen to more episodes?
Jump over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/MMIH and you can listen to the entire back catalog of episodes for just $1.99 a month.
That's an additional 300 episodes that aren't on iTunes that you can listen to whenever you please.
But without any more blibber blabber, back to the show!
Arik, what do you remember about our chat with Cecilia?
Oh my God, that I had so many questions for her and we only had a short amount of time. And I really wanted to like make sure that every question I asked was like a great question that she could really give a good answer to. And I feel like most of the time, like she just came up with the best things to say to anything that we asked. It was, yeah. It was great. And to the point where I think your last question was like, You just gave like the best advice in your last answer. Like, do you have any other great advice? And it just gave the best advice ever. It was incredible. I was like, wow, you are just a fountain of like filmmaking knowledge and encouragement. My God. Yeah, I don't know. She was just amazing. And I mean, I feel like the whole story she told about like how she got Bob Odenkirk and Danny Huston and Radha Mitchell to get on the show, like, or get into, you know, her movie. Like, there's two ways you could look at it. You could look at it as a total cynic and being like, yeah, like, you just have to know these people in order to, like, actually make your movie. Like, oh, I don't know famous people. Like, I can't do it. Or you can look at it as, like, the total optimist and be like, oh, if you make movies long enough and you keep on making movies, you're gonna know people who are famous one day. Like, they may not be famous when you meet them, but like if you're in the game and you're like going out there and like getting actors and blah, 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 like you're gonna make connections, which like in 20 years or something, like they're gonna pay off, right? So like I took it as a very like positive thing. Like, yeah, you just need to keep doing your craft and do it well, and you know, you'll have opportunities are going to come one day. They're going to come, things are going to line up eventually, you know. But what about you? What did you remember from the conversation?
No, I was just thinking back, and it's like, I know I talk about this a lot, but like her unabashed confidence is so beautiful. Like her just saying, like, I remember just asking, like, because I get intimidated by every aspect of filmmaking, and I was like trying to see if there was, what is it called, like a clink in her armor. Like I was like, is there something that kind of like overwhelms her at all? And she was just like, no, I love it all, I'm good at it all. And it wasn't, sometimes that could be really abrasive to me, right? If someone's really confident and snuffy about it, I don't know what the word is, but just kind of like stuck up or whatever. But it was like, yeah, she is wonderful and she deserves every accolade and she's proven herself with her career. And I just found that very magnetic, like her whole personality and her confidence. And it kind of reminded me of, like, I'm trying to think, it's like Amber Seeley, Talia Lugosi, like other filmmakers we've had on the show who are like, I'm really good at this, you know, like I'm really good at this. I like hearing artists who have faith in themselves. That's what I got out of Cecilia.
Nice. Yeah, it does feel like there is confidence. It's like confidence is a through line through all, like, a lot of the directors that we talk to. And it's like not necessarily, it doesn't always come out in the same way. Like sometimes it's confidence and like, I am great or I'm really good at this. So I knew it was going to work. Or sometimes it comes out in ways where they just go for things and they just make these decisions and just take these leaps, you know, and they don't worry about it. So it's funny, like how confidence is a key that presents itself in different ways, you know, in different people. So very interesting. What is also extremely interesting and very, very exciting, as always, is this week's round of The Game. So for those of you who don't know, The Game is something that Eric Toms, our producer, came up with, which is really, really beautiful. It's basically like a challenge, like a filmmaking, indie filmmaking challenge, where every week we have a question that is asked either by me to Liz or by Liz to me of like this challenge, this quandary, this situation that you're in while you're making a movie. And like, you know, we're tasked to figure out a way to solve it, basically. And so I've got this question for this week for Liz to solve. I have not read this. Liz has not heard this yet. So this is going to be fresh off the press. So here we go. Your first indie film was released and was a critical and financial success. Wow. All right. Already in fantasy dreamland. This is great. It's so successful that an up-and-coming star wants to work on your second film. However, the film falls apart and you have to take on other jobs to continue working. Okay. A few years later, you're attached to another feature and the main actor would be perfect for the same up-and-coming star. The main character would be perfect for the same up-and-coming star. Although you two haven't spoken for a long time, you've left on good terms. To try to get the star's attention regarding this project, do you dig up their information and reach out directly, reach out to the star's new representation whom you have no relationship with and present the project, forget them altogether and reach out to other actors, or D, other? What do you do, director? What do you do?
Is this a trick? Is this another trick? I'm like, because this feels easy, right? It's like someone that you like working with, who wants to work with you, who is a powerful, famous actor, who you once were in contact with, right?
Yeah.
It is good for the next project. I mean, I guess the question is digging up their contact information. Do you not have it? Do you not have the contact information from the first project?
I mean, I'm assuming that you probably have the phone number, right? But I mean, maybe we have to assume that we don't have the number. And so that you're basically trying to get their number through other sources, you know?
Well, you always have to involve the reps. You always have to involve the reps. But if you have their email address, what you do is you kind of float the idea to them first, and then you two together incorporate the reps in the way that's the best way possible. But I would go direct first if I had a relationship with them, and then loop in the reps right afterwards, or loop in the reps if I can't get in contact with them directly. But this seems like making a mountain out of a molehill. I'm like, this seems like a very minor question. I don't see the problem with it. How would you answer? Did I not hear it right?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the question lies in like, is it like awkward or weird to like approach
if the project
this person?
Falls apart? No, that's not
but
weird
like,
at all.
3 years later, like you haven't talked to them. Like, here's a real example in my life. So I have Val Kilmer's number in my phone because I, you know, worked with him on this movie like 12 years ago. Would it be weird if I called Val Kilmer to ask him to be in a project? Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Because you didn't direct that project 12 years ago. Unless you did. Did you direct it 12 years ago?
Unless my name's Francis Ford Coppola, the answer is no.
So, okay. But if you were
I had to call him and whatever. And, you know, he called me and stuff.
No, I'm with you.
Not acceptable, right?
Yeah, not exactly. Acceptable. But if you were one of the lead producers or the director, you're fine. You could call them up, you know? But if you're not, no, you have to play the game and you have to go through their reps first. But if they specifically wanted to work with you, you were the draw of the original project that fell apart, that you have that cachet. You could do it, I think, and you could call them directly.
Yeah, I think if you've already texted with them before in regards to a project that you would direct, and then it just didn't work out and you left on good terms, of course you just text them or call them or email them or whatever. If you for some reason didn't have their direct contact information for some weird, strange reason, I still think you try to go to them directly, however you can, you know, because that's just going to be a stronger way in. Like, if you go to the agent or manager first, like, you're going to have to play those games. But if, like, you already have the relationship, like, I would go through the relationship and then, like you said, bring the agents and managers in later, you know? Yeah. Or do like Cecilia and not bring them in at all.
That's right. But it's about patience. Like, I think if I didn't have their contact information, I probably would be too lazy to try to find someone who knew someone who knew someone who could get me there. I probably would just contact the manager because I could easily get that information on IMDb Pro.
Yeah, but you could tweet them or you could Instagram, you know, you could, there's lots of different ways.
No one.
You wouldn't tweet at an actor that you've worked with before, like, hey, blah, blah, blah. You're a Twitter person. Isn't that what Twitter is for?
You and I are like maybe 6 months apart in age. And I think that 6 months apart is vital to like the DM world of social media. Like, I've never really I don't DM people. Like, I've tweeted at people, but not in a way that would make me look vulnerable. Like, I need you. Please talk to me. I need to get in contact with. I don't think I do that. Maybe I do and I don't realize it. But
I don't think it has anything to do with age. I think that has something to do with personality.
No, the DM thing. The DM thing, I think, is age, because this, like, maybe you don't, but I feel like there's a bunch of people who are like, yeah, just DM me. And I'm like, no, email me. Like, no, I don't want to DM you. What's that?
Well, I think that's more like a Twitter thing where you just like, you know, it's, I don't know, Twitter people DM people. I don't know. I'm not like a Twitter person.
Oh, I'm thinking of Instagram. I'm thinking of like Instagram culture where they're like, just hit up my DMs.
Yeah.
Is that age difference between us? That's not okay. So that's, you don't do DMs either.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't even know. Can you DM people in Instagram? I guess
you
I
can.
Oh, yeah,
if
you
they
can.
Have their DMs open. If they have the DMs open, you can. And then with Twitter, a lot less people have their like inboxes open or whatever. Because I do try to get in contact, because I do the distributor report cards with the Film Collaborative. So I'm constantly looking for ways to get in touch with filmmakers. Mm. And like a lot of them don't have their messages available on Twitter. But I wouldn't tweet at them publicly and be like, hey, hit me up. I would rather just email them.
I thought the cool kids just tweeted at people.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I was thinking. I thought the age thing might be the cool kid difference.
Oh, I see.
But
I thought that was, no. I didn't think it had to do with age. I just thought it had to do with like Twitter fluency, you know? Like,
no.
I thought that was like a Twitter.
Maybe. Thing. All I know is I would just be like, ugh, whatever. I'm just going to contact the manager. Like, I just wouldn't go through that.
That's so
that.
Funny. Yeah. I don't know. So,
we're in agreement, pretty much.
We're pretty much agreement. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think I would do whatever I could to go, because I feel like it's like the personal relationship is like what it's like. That's what drives this industry, is like personal relationships. It seems like the more that you know people, like the better you're going to have a chance of getting anything done. So I would just lean into that, you know. And if you didn't have a relationship with the manager or the agent, it's like, I don't know. But I guess on the other hand, if you're like this kind of director who's gotten stars approaching you, then you probably shouldn't have a problem going to the agent, because they'll be like, oh yeah, Liz Manischel, of course, sure, we'll make the offer, no problem.
You contact the manager. You go like, I won Sundance 5 years ago. Hey,
you know,
can I get in touch with you?
I'm going to give a little grief to Eric right now. I never do this, but like, I feel like making the person in this question have this kind of success, I think makes the question too easy to answer.
That's what I'm saying. I thought that was a catch. Success. Too easy.
You can't have success, because if you have success and critical acclaim and financial whatever, it's like you don't have so many problems anymore. Like, you could just do shit. Like, if we had that kind of backing on any of our previous films, like, we would not have any of the problems that we're dealing with now. But I don't know.
No, we need that one movie.
Yeah. I don't know. But people talk, you know, reach out. If you've had critical and financial success on your first feature and you're still having issues, I'd love to hear about it. But I don't think that person exists. I think that person is a made-up person. Anyways, if you want to suggest a question for the game or scenario, or you just want to ask us a question about anything else, or you want to comment on what we said, or you think we're wrong about all the things that we say on the show, you can send us an email to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. Or if you like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes. I still think that the 2023 spot is open for first 2023 reviews. You know, people, get it while you can. And finally, check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Movies Is Hard Podcast. You make sure to check out the International Screenwriters Association, the ISA. They're an organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers through a number of programs they offer, including publishing your logline to a network of industry professionals, consultation courses, and contests. So be sure to head over to www.networkisa.org to sign up for free today. Thanks to Cecilia Minucci for coming on the show. Thanks to Caitlin Flanagan from Falco Inc. for setting this all up. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimuth, for doing the editing. And thanks to our producer, Eric Doms, for just being awesome. Thank you all for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Can you talk a little bit about the origin of the idea for the film? Oh, sorry, Auric. It was Auric's question. I stole his question.
What would you like me to say? Two ones.
Yeah, question? My question.
Women first, right? Ladies yeah. first.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.